Blog Talk Radio.
In the beginning was the beat, and the beat was the rhythm of God, and the rhythm of God is the harmony of humanity, and where there is harmony, there is peace.
Program that comes to you live every Thursday evening at 9 o'clock p.m. Tonight we are wrestling with the question, socialism or capitalism, which way should America go? You can join the conversation and we'll be right back in a minute. Stay tuned. Don't go anywhere. Family, and welcome, brothers and sisters, to Dare to Win, Us Lifting Us Economic Development Cooperative, LLC, our weekly radio broadcast coming to you live via Blog Talk Radio. Tonight, we are joined by a couple of members of the board of directors of Us Lifting Us, Baba Hekima, one of the founding board members. I believe Sister Nanana will also be sharing with us tonight. And as I said at the beginning of the hour, we're going to be exploring the question that has popped up in the 2020 election cycle, socialism or capitalism, which way forward for America? To join tonight's conversation, dial 929-477-2789. Press the number 1 on your keypad, and that will raise your hand in the studio, and we will open the lines and allow you to make a comment or ask a question. We also invite you to visit the Us Lifting Us website at usliftingus.com. That's USLIFTINGUS.com, where you can get the full explanation of our platform and our program. So by all means, if you have not been to our website before, please get there as quick as you can, usliftingus.com. Also, if you need to reach us by landline, you can call the office at 404-592-2780. Again, that's 404-592-2780. So before we get to the question and get into the conversation tonight, I want to say welcome to Brother Hekima and Sister Nanana. Baba K. Hekima, how are you feeling this evening?
I'm doing well, brother. I'm really thrilled that we're going to hear our sister's voice on the broadcast this evening. But yeah, we're doing well. May feel overworked from time to time, but you know, that's why we're here, to advance what we think is a necessary cause. And so I'm just grateful to be with the family again on Thursday, and looking forward to the discussion.
Okay, well, thank you, brother. It's good to hear you. Sister Nanana, are you in the house?
Yes, I am in the house, and I am pleased to be here and to have the opportunity once again to share thoughts, ideas, concepts, and help to generate some energy and some understanding around this whole question of socialism versus capitalism versus other options that might be out there that would be beneficial for us. I think this is very key dialogue that we're having this evening. So thank you for giving me the opportunity.
And we're glad to hear you. For those of you who may not know, Sister Nanana lives in Denver, Colorado, and they're in the midst of a blizzard. Hurricane winds in the, you know, gusting up to 90 miles an hour. It's not trying to blow you away out there, is it, Sister Nanana?
So far, I have not been blown away. However, we have had some trees blown down and quite a bit of damage to power lines. The majority of people have had power restored now, but there's an awful lot of damage, and it has been a challenge for people to get around because the highways have been shut down. Today, there were many attempts to reopen the highways, and oddly enough, what prevented the reopening of several interstate and local streets was not so much the snow as it was the abandoned vehicles. People literally leaving their vehicles because either they could not move them or they had crashed or whatever. So we had literally thousands of vehicles that were left abandoned on streets and highways. And today it was a major task to get out there with tow trucks and other things to try to clear them away. So it's been a little bit of an ordeal.
Okay.
Sure.
Well, it's interesting. Brother Hekima, were you about to say something?
No, I was just saying, wow. I mean, that's rough. I didn't know it was quite that bad. Yeah,
and Sister Nanana and I had texted earlier, and she was saying even this time of year are not unusual for Denver, but that the winds gusting up to 90 miles an hour in some places at some times, That's a kind of a new wrinkle, and maybe in some ways connected with global warming, which is a topic we will have to explore in the very near future on this broadcast, because there are a number of pressing issues that we need to talk about in the United States, and unfortunately, we find ourselves the leadership is just not up to the task. And one of the things that we said at the beginning of the hour was that it appears that an emerging question being thrown about in the 2020 election cycle is this question of socialism or capitalism. And we even had the president saying, you know, America will always be a capitalist country. And, you know, and of course, his fan base, they roared their approval to that remark. But to try to answer this question, we must start with clear definitions of each. So, Baba Hekima, before we tackle socialism, let's provide our listeners with a working definition of capitalism. And let's touch on a couple of points. I think first and foremost is this private ownership of the means of production. So that's important. We need to get that out. We're going to talk about that a little bit. And then that capitalism in the Western world, mainly Europe and the United States system. We also probably need to touch on the fact that it is a theft system and it's non-democratic. So let's just kind of walk through those points and any others that you want to inject to really talk about capitalism as an economic system, not a political system, but an economic system, and how we have experienced that system. Baba Hakima, let's start with you, and then Sister Nanana, if you care to add some clarity to this, we certainly want to hear mm-hmm. your perspective.
Thank you.
Yes, and of course, there is all kinds of flowery language and packaging to what you call a theft system that makes it sound to some people rational. You know, shouldn't you benefit from your own labor? Shouldn't you benefit, in other words, if you built the factory, shouldn't you have the right to run it the way you want to and establish a wage? So, but this system of private ownership of the means of production and distribution and, you know, and the financial institutions and the firms that crop up to support it, and ultimately the governmental system that is in support of it, you know, all collude to benefit a small elite group, as we know. And I'm reminded that the germ seed, the acele, so to speak, of capitalism is private self-interest. Private self-interest, not just a self-interest. I don't think self-interest is a bad thing. I think everyone would have self-interest. But private self-interest as opposed to self-interest as a part of the group or as a part of the collective. And so this private self-interest expresses itself in profit at any measure, dog-eat-dog, rugged individualism. I got mine, so you know you got to get yours. And it's a system, it's a predatory system that is very artful at dividing and conquering. I remember as a youth, you know, there were children and adults. Those are the only divisions between, you know, people. You were either a child or you were adult. And you got so many gradations today that the marketplace seeks to separate people into segments so that they can market and capture that market. And so everything is in bits and pieces. So that's the system, you know, from my perspective of capitalism. And it goes further than just the marketplace. It seeps into every crack and crevice of social life. It's really a value system, and I'm sure we're going to talk more about that as we go further into it. Thank you.
And well, thank you, Brother Hakima. This notion of private self-interest, I think that's a key concept. I grew up at a time when the slogan was, get all you can all you get, and then sit on the can. And it spoke to a kind of way of this dog-eat-dog way of being in the world that gets glorified and lifted up as something to be admired. Sister Hakima, I mean, Sister Nanana, any thoughts on this aspect of the conversation?
Well, what really strikes me as being vitally important around the capitalistic philosophy is the piece that Baba Hakima mentioned as far as private ownership that is so focal. And the first thing identified in private ownership, as far as capitalism is concerned, is private ownership of the land. I think that's very key for us to be aware of, that capitalism promotes private ownership of the land, because absolutely all wealth, everything, starts with the land, comes from the land. So who owns and who develops, who controls, who maintains, who caretakes the land is of utmost importance. And in the capitalistic system, which is combined with, say, straight up inaccurate information, lies, concerning the original ownership of the land, not only in North America, but in other places. But as we examine that, I think it makes it easier for us to understand why the system of politics that we have continually promote private ownership, and that is to mask who really owns the land? Who are the true autochthonous, original, indigenous first people of the land? Those are the ones who truly own the land and who should be in control of it, and therefore have major say-so in terms of how the land is used. And, of course, when we delve into that, it leads us into a situation where we have to peel away many, many layers of misinformation around that, particularly here in North America. So just the one piece around land ownership, I think, is absolutely vital for us to understand that capitalism is in place in order to maintain the control of the land, because that's where all wealth comes from. And if there is any other system in place other than capitalism, then there is a risk to the powers that be that they might not anymore be as much in control of everything as they would like to be. So I'll let that rest at, you know, with those comments, but I think the land ownership piece is important for us to understand.
That is a very profound concept that you introduce into this conversation, and it may even sound a little odd to the ears of those of us raised in America that private land ownership is problematic. It would be better understood when we think about cultures where land was considered a gift for everyone's use, but could not be owned privately by anyone. So we've been so far removed from thinking like that, that when you raise the idea that private ownership of land is problematic, It almost strikes our ear very strangely. But your comment goes to the heart of the matter. The only way that you can own the land is just you have to hold it by force. And so when Europeans descended on North America, when they came in onto the African continent, they eventually had to break out the guns and the ammunition. Because the only way that you are going to dispossess people of their own land is by force. So when we talk about capitalism as being the private ownership of the means of production, land is certainly one of the most critical aspects of means of production. You first have to have land. Then you can go to tools and factories and machinery and seeds and all the other components of the means of production. But as you so rightly point out, Sister Nanana, it starts with taking possession of the land. The other thing I think that is not really appreciated enough by African descended people living in this in the United States, certainly because of the schooling that we were exposed to, we did not understand that chattel slavery as practiced in the West, the United States, in terms of the Atlantic slave trade and the East African slave trade, that enslaved African people being reduced to chattel or property, we too became means of production. In other words, we ceased being human and we became commodities to be bought and sold and bred and traded and worked like farm animals. And you cannot separate the evolution of capitalism from that trade and that enslavement of African people and people of color. So those of us that want to make an argument for capitalism being a really good system, they have to understand that it is based on initially on the enslavement of African people. And so it is a theft system. The land was stolen, the people were stolen, and then even people who continue to work on jobs and receive a wage, we often don't realize that what we are being paid is a portion of the wealth that we have created. So all of us go into these factories or into these retail businesses, and working together, we generate business, and that business generates a surplus value or a profit. We get paid a wage, which is a portion of the total profit, and the people who say they own the business, that is back to this private ownership, they put the difference of that surplus wealth that all of us created, that goes in their pocket. So even on a good day, capitalism is still a system of organized theft. And that's why when we see the struggle going on to raise the minimum wage from $7 an hour to a livable wage of $15 an hour, what is being fought for is a larger portion of the wealth that the people who are doing the work have created. And so the argument is skewed and is presented back to the workers as we can't pay $15 an hour. If we pay $15 an hour, that'll cut into the profit, and then the business won't survive, and then we'll go out of business. All of that is nonsense. The wealth that the system produces is the combined energy and labor of everybody involved. So the question really comes down to who should control how the surplus is distributed. And we know on that question, the people who do the work aren't allowed to make those kinds of decisions. So that helps us, I think, to get some grounding in capitalism. You notice we didn't talk anything about voting and elections and all of that nonsense that usually goes along with touting capitalism as such a great system. It is an economic system that allows at its core base private ownership of the means of production. And so we're going to take a quick, let me just pause here and see if there are any questions on the line. I see 3440 wants to make a comment and join the conversation. So let me open that line. Caller, tell us your name and where you're calling from and give us your comment.
Greetings, family. This is Brother Shabaka. I'm calling from Baltimore, Maryland. Very interesting and good conversation that you all are having. Don't really have much of a question. Just wanted to add to a couple of things that you were saying, particularly dealing with the land and its value in terms of being the fundamental means of production, is everything springs forth from that. including human beings. You know, we're made of everything that you find on the earth. And so that process of evolution caused us to be now, what we see ourselves as now, and eventually in the development of societies, we are able to use resources encapsulated by the earth and make tools and what have you. Another important factor is that probably some of your listening audience might say, well, give a justification for the way in which things are happening and that really they see no change. I just want to remind, brothers and sisters out there that this right now, 2019, is supposed to represent 400 years since the first enslaved African were brought to the shores of the U.S., Virginia. And so we are the descendants, a lot of us are the descendants of the captives who were kidnapped and prisoners of war. We have been separated, although intermingling, we have interacted with our culture on the African continent, but we have been separated in mass from that experience for 400 years, and we have been indoctrinated to think that what we are experiencing now is what is, and because as a consequence of the wealth that we had created, which allowed the U.S. And American society become extremely powerful and rich. I remember now, our enslavement and the stealing of wealth created from us allowed the United States to become extremely powerful and rich, where it can begin to globally subjugate and force its hand was a result of the enslavement of us. And so we might become confused that, it's great. And, of course, the educational system, public education being insisted upon is nothing but an indoctrination. I mean, I've learned that. I'm in the educational field, and one of the things that was pointed out to me is our objective is to change behavior. The educational system is to change behavior so that you support the status quo. And so as we look for jobs, all right, and not necessarily look for ownership, not necessarily put ourselves out for businesses, we're not given those opportunities as some people are. And, of course, we've seen the corruption that's been propping up with these so-called Ivy League schools and what have you. Just wanted to add that we've been indoctrinated. things were very much different. The private ownership was somewhat alien concept to our African experience, and so in order to remove the tentacles of the oppressive condition that we are experiencing, we must have something that reversed the process of the private ownership into collective ownership of production means. So that's all I wanted to say, and sisters, good to hear that you came through the storm. We're always satisfied and glad that things are working out well for you in the cold hills of Denver. Thank you.
Thank you for very astute commentary, reiterating that the importance of the fact that land was stolen, and that's the primary problem that we're dealing with, but also the idea that we have been separated from the land of our birth for 400 years and have been subjected to a very sophisticated brainwashing and indoctrination so that we don't even recognize how alien some of these concepts are. And you then mentioned the fact that as an alternative to that, we have to look at some systems where the means of production are collectively owned. So we're going to take a quick music break, and as soon as we come back on the other side of the screen, how do we regain control of the production of ourselves in the direction that it is sustainable. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. Freedom, and we at Us Lifting Us, that's exactly what we have on our minds, putting together an organization and economic model that will really guarantee our freedom. As we went to break, Baba Shabaka gave us a very excellent segue into talking about a definition of socialism. So, Baba Hekima, how should we understand socialism as an economic construct? And Sister Nanana, feel free to weigh in after Baba Hekima as we talk about socialism and begin to move towards the ULU solution, that is cooperative models to capture the means of production. Baba Hekima?
Mm-hmm.
Talk to us.
And almost a reverse of what we were talking about earlier, where the major means of production were hands of individuals or private individuals. In a socialistic economic system, the primary or the major means of production and commercial activity is in the hands of the state or the state apparatus, for the benefit of the total population. In its extreme, all means of production are in the hands of the state. In most examples that we can see today, some means, major means, are held, and there may be a mixture as well. But the notion is that in the socialistic model, the collective, the group, the people are primary, and so the self-interest is on behalf of what is at the heart of what is good, beneficial, and safe, and for the group as opposed to the individual. But again, you mentioned earlier, in this election season, there are already schisms and many discussions about socialism versus communism, versus capitalism. And it's very likely that there are going to be sharp discussions and debates around these two competing systems. And for probably the first time in my life, and I'm in my 70s now, there is a sizable percentage of the American population and the European population who favor socialism over capitalism. So because of the systemic crisis and contradictions in capitalism, more and more people and individuals are coming around to favor some form of socialistic policy, and in some cases, socialistic overtake or control of the primary or major means of production overall. that would be what I would offer to start the discussion.
Thank you. Sister Nanana, how would you help us think about this?
Well, what comes up for me in terms of socialism, particularly looking at it through the lens of what we have to deal with here in the U.S. I see socialism as a kind of a half step in between capitalism and where we really need to be. And I can't help but wonder whether or not a socialistic model, if in fact put into action or into use, would just be a way of masking the control and the ownership of the means of production of the land, and that it would really still be capitalism. That's a concern that I have about socialism being marketed particularly by those who are running for political office, that they may truly not be promoting socialism, but really promoting a shield or something that may look as if the people's best interests are being represented by a government. And so I'm kind of struggling with this piece, as you can see, because I don't believe that it has enough clarity around it in terms of the actual nuts and bolts of how to make it work, particularly here in the U.S., that it would truly be viable for us.
Mm-hmm.
So I have concerns about a socialistic model from that perspective, that it might not really be what it is touted to be, and that is providing a way for the government to control truly on the behalf of the people. I'm having difficulty seeing how this government, which has been very, very controlling on behalf of the few and the very rich, how it would then switch to be controlling and truly representing the benefits of the majority of the people.
Mm. You know, you raise a very critical issue for all change agents, all of those who consider themselves on the progressive side of the spectrum. You know, how do we wrest control of the means of production from the greedy claws of the 1%? It doesn't seem like that's going to happen. And that's why in the European models, they talked about socialism was the dictatorship of the proletariat, or the dictatorship of the working class, over against the dictatorship of the bourgeoisie, which is what we see in both Western Europe and the United States. And I think both of those models, to your point, Sister Nanana, stem from the understanding that in both capitalism and socialism, at least as presented in the European framework, they both adhere to an idea that ultimate reality is material. So they may be opposite sides of the same coin. It takes a different philosophical construct to really come up with an alternative economic system that goes in a completely different trajectory. And by that, what I mean, for example, is in indigenous peoples and certainly African people on the continent, for thousands of years before Europeans even showed up on the borders of the continent, had the idea and still hold the idea that ultimate reality is spirit, that the land is a gift to the people from the Creator. It can't be sold, it can only be used, that the earth is a living organism. These are ideas that are very alien to Europeans who come out of a context of scarcity and survival of the fittest. They don't seem to be comfortable in sharing power, especially when mm-hmm. they're in the minority and they have to share power with people of color who make up 9/10 of the earth's population. So to your point about are they really ready to share power, to relinquish power, that definitely remains to be seen. But I think what's important for us to understand is that what we need to be clear about is that under capitalism, that's private ownership of the means of production. Under socialism or democratic socialism, that's, at least in theory, the collective ownership of the means of production. And as you pointed out, Sister Nanana and Baba Hekima, that people ownership of the means of production was through the government or the state. In other words, the government or the state operates the society on the behalf of the people. And so I think we've seen some benefits, for example, the idea of Medicare for all. That's a socialist idea, and I think most of us would agree that that makes for a better healthcare model than what we have seen when it's only healthcare for those who can afford it. This idea of education from kindergarten to your 4-year bachelor's degree being paid for by the government. I think that's a powerful idea. And certainly putting in place practices and policies that can begin to grapple with the very real issue of global warming. This is not something that we can put off for 10 years and get around to, when we are finally confronted with climate catastrophe. So this idea of who controls the means of production should be a question that gets put to all of the candidates vying for votes. And for those people who say private ownership of the means of production is okay, whether they black, white, purple, or yellow, or something in between, then we're clear about what kinds of systems they want to keep in place. What I want to do is, in the time that we have remaining, because I want to leave several minutes at the end of the broadcast to talk about our annual meeting, which starts tomorrow, the ULU Annual Convention and Members Meeting, runs this Friday, Saturday, and Sunday at the ITC, the Interdenominational Theological Center, here in Atlanta, Georgia, which is located at 730 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard. We'll talk about that a little bit later in the broadcast. But I do want to begin to segue from the conversation around socialism to talking about why the ULU cooperative model really helps us to circumvent the political issues and affords people of color and people of African descent an opportunity to right now begin to build means of production that are collectively and group-owned and family-centered. So we're going to take another quick music break, and then we will come back and continue the discussion on the cooperative model that Us Lifting Us is recommending for our people. Quick break, and we'll be right back. Economic Development Cooperative Thursday night broadcast, Dare to Win. My name is Brother Kimbizi, and we are talking with Baba Hekima and Sister Nana, who are board members of Us Lifting Us. And we've been having a conversation about socialism versus capitalism. And where we are right now is we want to talk about the cooperative model that Us Lifting Us is projecting and building, and why we believe that this offers a sustainable and viable path forward for our community. Again, to join the conversation, dial 929-477-2789. Again, 929-477-2789, and press the number 1 on your keypad, and that will raise your hand in the studio, and we will open your phone line so that you can make a comment or raise a question. So, Baba Hekima, let's talk about the Us Lifting Us cooperative model and how this offers us a path forward that is both sustainable and viable and doable right now.
Yes, and just a reflection, when Gil Scott says that the revolution will not be televised, certainly it's not been televised of all of the activity on the planet of people at the grassroots, bottom-up kinds of movements that are bringing collectives into being and experimenting with different models. And, of course, it's been happening all along. Of course, in our culture, the Isusus, and, of course, they have different names in other parts of the world. Even my family participates in a birthday club, which is, you know, essentially an Isusu. So all along, regardless of what has been occurring at the broad governmental level, people have found ways to pool their energies and resources and address needs as small collectives. in recent history, there have been some successes at large-scale cooperatives, large-scale group-owned enterprises that began to compete with the larger corporations that have name recognition around the world. We're talking about group-owned enterprises that do business in the multi-billion-dollar per year arena, $15 to $20 billion and more. And so, as we, as Africans in America and in other parts of the world, began to look at what we can do from the community level up and not wait for governments and really not trusting them anyway. So with ULU, we are just one of those expressions of people on the planet looking inward in terms of what we can do to address the problem based on our culture, based on what we perceive as the end goal, so to speak. And so for ULU, we have put in place a business structure that can accommodate hundreds, thousands, tens of thousands, and eventually millions of participants, both individuals and institutions, and aggregate our resources and do some fantastic things in furtherance of our economic and social needs. So essentially, we favor us pooling our resources, using those resources to open and run for-profit businesses that are structured as co-ops but that we own, and then running those businesses so that we can produce a surplus that benefits the community through job creation, through stimulating the economy in our local areas, through contributing to charity, but also a profit-sharing aspect. And we look forward to, again, growing this to large scale. And, again, we've experimented with co-ops, in particular in the black community, even before, quote-unquote, emancipation. And but this is perhaps the first time that we have looked at growing it to truly large scale. And that's been the challenge with co-ops generally around the world, is how do you scale them up so that it's not just a nice thing, but it impacts the community from a power perspective as well. I'll stop there.
Okay. Sister Nana, you want to add to that?
Well, yes, thank you for the opportunity. I am encouraged by the use of cooperative economics within our communities. I think that by putting to use the co-op economic plan that ULU has, that we strengthen ourselves in some ways, in one way in particular that is absolutely vital, and that is that we strengthen the family. In a cooperative economic environment, because of the fact that a specific group of people within a geographic area come together and are in agreement as to what this business is, how it's going to be ran. They participate in the decision making around it. Jobs are created that they can see definitely benefit the community, and those who own units or shares in the business, in addition to their wages, they have dividends paid out to them. All of this makes a circle and comes back to strengthening the family, making it possible for the family to work together as a unit. And in addition to that, It sets a model and a path for future generations to follow. Future generations begin to look at this process and to see the benefits that they have achieved from it. Therefore, they can embrace it and then pass it on to generations after them. So it has a very positive and far-reaching effect, I judge, on the family structure overall. And for us as African-descended people living here in North America, that's something that that we need to do everything that we possibly can to keep our families strong. And this would be a way of doing it, and definitely establishing that we have full and total capability of taking care of ourselves. And there's just no replacement for all of the positive, very positive self-images and very positive legacies that are passed on to young people, just from the perspective of knowing that we are self-sufficient in and of ourselves, and that we have shed that legacy that we have had from the past of being at a very low rung on the economic ladder and always being at least partially dependent on some government program or, you know, special needs program or something of that nature. So I'll stop with that because I don't want to start rambling, but in a nutshell, cooperative economics, from my perspective, that is definitely, without a question, the route that we need to be going. And we are at a point where it is the option for us to choose. So thank you for the opportunity to comment.
Well, thank you. And as you point out, both you and Baba Hekima, it's the cooperative model that allows us to exercise our agency right now. We don't have to wait on the government. We don't have to wait on other organizations. We begin to organize our money, pool it, and then open cooperative businesses, small, medium, and large scale. That means that all of the businesses that we operate are owned collectively by our membership. And just to give you an example, during the convention that starts tomorrow here in Atlanta at the ITC, at the Franklin Auditorium, please make plans to be with us. We start at 9 o'clock, and we're going to go till 5. We have a meet and greet on Friday night at Cafe Ulu, the first business that Us Lifting Us has started. 2036 Sylvan Road in Atlanta, Cafe Ulu. It's an internet lounge and coffee shop and cafe. Invited to come by. Meet with us, share your ideas, your thoughts about what you're hearing, and then Saturday and Sunday we'll get together for the business portion of our work. To become a member of ULU, it's a $50 annual fee, and we'll talk about the other mechanics as we get into the business itself. So I want to say thank you to Baba Hekima, and to Sister Nanana and Brother Shabaka and all of those on the call tonight for your presence. We are about to take care of important business for African-descended people. The thing that's really excited about Us Lifting Us is that if you are a member of Us Lifting Us, you have a vote. And in our organization, one member, one vote. So it is truly a democratic apparatus. We'll make decisions about which way we need to go, what other businesses are we ready to launch, all of that, and you can be part of that conversation. So, again, that's Friday night, the mixer at 6 o'clock at Cafe Ulu, 2036 Sylvan Road in Atlanta. And then Saturday and Sunday at the ITC, the Interdenominational Theological Center, located at 730 Martin Luther King Jr. Boulevard in the Franklin Auditorium. So if you have questions, you need more information, you can call our office, 404-592-2780. Visit us at our website, usliftingus.com. Again, that's USLIFTINGUS.com. And become a part of this dynamic history-making event led by our people for our people. And we'll see you next week.